Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. I had to cut Kirk off there. Kirk Gray's with me today. Hey, Kirk.
Hi, Fred.
Yeah, I had to cut you off there. We started talking about what topics we wanted to talk about today. And I said, come on, Kirk, let me hit record. This is all good stuff. Yeah. So I'm going to throw this out right away to you. Is we were just talking about an article I wrote, a couple of weeks ago, I think it is now, from when we're recording this. And we'll link to it in the show note. And it was on the idea, I don't remember his exact title, but it was, is a profit from a failure a good idea? And in the article, I talked about a couple different situations where companies are basically like, I had one client that was making it was some kind of radar or sensor detector box, very high sophistication, way fancy. You know, they never really explained what it did to me. I didn't need to know. You know, right. I think they would have had to kill me if I knew or something like that. They sold them because of their contract with the military, was they would get a 10% profit on what they did. And they had a contract of exactly how many to make, how much it was going to cost. They were pretty rigidly fixed on a cost plus contract. And so, then they set it up saying, all right, well, we're the only ones that can really fix this. And they convinced the government that they were the only ones that could open the box and do repairs or fixes or improvements. And they made all. And so when I talked to them about improving their reliability, because the military is complaining that their boxes fail all the time, I said, well, you need to improve the reliability. And they said, no, wait a second here. If we do that, they'll pay us to make the improvements and then give us a little bit of profit, and then we'll lose money on repairs. We make 90% of our profits fixing these things. So there's no incentive for us to make it. And then I used another example of a factory that was designing and manufacturing, I think it was a computer box of some sort. And they said, well, another service we offer is we can do the repairs. Right? Well, over half their profit came from repairs. And there's really no incentive for them to actually improve the reliability by design or in their process. And
it's a conflict of interest.
It is. And I've run into this a number of times. And the military guys, they're out of business, right?
Right.
They had the contract for a few years. The military got fed up with them and said, you know, we can't afford this. This is ridiculous. You need to fix this. And they were bound by these archaic and weird ways military contracts, at least in the U.S., are written.
Right, right.
In the way Congress works. I mean, our system's just screwed as far as
It's a very deeply embedded cultural methodology that they use. And it echoes what I've heard from those workers and engineers in the and they're some of them are very frustrated because they know that when you have one of them walked up to me at the ASTR conference in workshop in Ontario, or I think it was Ontario, one of the Canada ones we had. And he said, well, this halt and hass would be a lot easier to do, you know, prevention, if it weren't for that 60% of our program's profits come from spares and service. And I myself have experienced this as recently as last year when I was contracting to a company that was making a new piece of hardware. They had been used to working with the military and government contracting, at least another branch of their business, and their whole culture was that they would bid into the market, you know, produce the product, and then
make up and their money off
spare parts, right? Yeah. And this was in the oil drilling industry, and I thought, God, the the loss when an oil well or system goes down is tremendous, and you risk irritating your customer, in fact, costing him a lot more in a crew not being able to do their work and having a whole team of people sitting around than whatever you're making up in spares. But then there, once you've got this expensive equipment and it's in use, it's not going to be easy for the customer to switch to a different, and they may not even have the different tool. So actually, when I presented to them, they said, look, we need to have, we got to have some failures, sort of. In a way, that's what they were really saying. I said, all I can do is make your product reliable. I can't make it unreliable, okay? I can't allow for a certain percentage or control that.
I
don't think so.
No, and by design, you can make stuff so that it's not as robust, or it's more prone to vibration wear, or it's more prone to failures under different conditions. You can make it less robust.
Well, yes, you can. But how you know when that's going to be, where that exact in the end use case, it might, you've obviously got a very wide variety of end use conditions for this equipment.
Right.
And in all kinds of places in the world.
I mean, Kirk, just use the simple example. Now, keep in mind for the listeners here is that we're not advocating you do this. I think, Kirk, you and I are both on the same page that the design team's challenge and their obligation, and I think most designers agree with this, is that you understand what the customer environment is, how they're using, what problem they're trying to solve using your product, and you make a product that's able to do that over time so that it provides value to your customer.
Right.
This concept is because of the contracting nature, or this mindset that if they have to use my product, they have to pay for it to be working. And so I can make money on selling spares, or, it's like, I'll give you the razor blade handle, but you have to only buy my unique razor blades.
Right.
Tomahawk cruise missiles are the same way.
You can't go buy spare parts from Walmart. Okay.
Well, I'm not sure about that. There are parts of the country, I think. just speculating here, but so it is a business model where you become and people do it with specifications in the housing market. They become like smoke detectors. The first smoke detectors were optional. They tried selling them to builders or homeowners as a benefit to the homeowner and make it nice. And then they tried saying, well, it'll help reduce your insurance rate. Well, it wasn't a big deal. The insurance company says a fire is a fire. Most people don't. It's not a big problem. We're not going to change the rates. And then they said, all right, fire departments and cities, we're going to legislate. We're going to help you craft laws that says any new construction has to have a smoke alarm. Now it became required by law. And so now they sold gazillion smoke alarms, right? And so it's the same kind of thinking is let's make it required. Now, what I have the problem with is that I'm going to not make a reliable product on purpose, so that I can make money on the spares and the repairs and the service.
Now, right.
I much prefer, I remember you were at Dell. Were you there when the call centers were spectacular? People actually bought more products from Dell after their computer failed because the service department was so good. The call centers were so good. Or was that before your time there?
It might have been before my time. I think they were doing still had a strong call center and would do many things and jump through many hoops to get the customer satisfied.
Right. But when I was at HP, we were like, how are they doing this? And Dell was doing a bunch of stuff, especially in supply chain, that was really innovative. But one of the things they did that we at HP never did quite figure out was that jumping through hoops and just getting the customer satisfied to make the repair happen is we saw some surveys afterwards comparing the different computer companies and call centers and stuff, is customers that had the two computer systems were failed at about the same rates. Issues and problems and things happened were about the same. They weren't all that different. But if a person called Dell and got the service from them, they were like 10 times more likely to recommend Dell, to buy Dell again, to do all that stuff. Where if at HP, you're in menu tree purgatory and almost never got anything solved through the call center. And you'd have to do 3, 4, 5 calls. And then they'd say, oh, make sure it's like, oh, just reboot it and then call me back in the morning.
Right.
And it's just worthless.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because just a week ago, I had a good friend, one of my our close friends, bought a Dell Precision computer. And now I don't know the details of really what he was, because he's not technical, but he bought this really high end. I think he spent $3,000 with all the software bundled with it and all that, which is, to me, extreme for a Precision, for a high end workstation laptop. But anyway, the problem was he got the system, and now the delivery system for the software packages, such as Adobe Photoshop and some of the other things, are something that Dell doesn't send out, apparently, the CD. And in fact, the laptop doesn't have a DVD player in it. You have to buy that now as an external device.
Well, I have all the Photoshop stuff. They don't even sell box sets anymore. It's all online. Right. It's all subscription service.
It saves a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Except he was having the problem when he started downloading it through the Dell app or whatever the app was that he had. It would corrupt his hard drive or corrupt the drive. And he they even sent out a technician. And imagine the cost of that. I mean, and the technician replaced the hard drive, and he started to do the same thing again. I asked him, I said, his name is Egyos. He's a good friend of mine. He's from Latvia. But I said, did you ask the technician to go and install that software and see if that problem was occurring again? And the technician told him not to use that software to download.
That came with the package to do it.
It's like they gave him no alternative. So anyway, he went through the same process, had the same problem. It corrupted his drive. He had to erase it all. And he just said, okay, that's it. I've called. They come out. That's it. He gave it back, and he may be an HP. I don't know. He was talking about a Lenovo or an HP or something else. But they lost all their business not because of the hardware failing, but because of the delivery system for their software packages that they, update. Now, I don't know if he upgraded his Windows 10 or what, all the process he did. I would have loved to sit there. But that is that's where you talk about service. Yes, they were very quick to address it. They sent a technician out. They offered him money back. They did all kinds of things, but they couldn't give him a computer that had the applications on it. Call Dell, ask them to send the computer with those programs loaded on it. Well, that would be an exception to their very large system, and that really is not feasible for Dell. But all these other hoops that they jumped through, sending out a technician, replacing a hard drive, seemed to, they tried, and it
just
ended
didn't
up,
work.
Yeah, they lost a tremendous amount of money from that. So,
well, part of it is that there's now, if your friend had to have paid for that service tech to show up. Right. Now, like if your furnace goes out in your house, the guy's going to charge you $100 whether or not he does anything. He's going to cover his time and effort to get out there. If he has to buy parts or do repairs or whatever, then he's going to charge you appropriately. Where the problem I have is that if somebody and I ran into this years and years ago, is that I was at a conference and this guy from, I think it was from Whirlpool. It might have been Maytag, but it was one of the washer, dryer, dishwasher kind of companies. It was amazing how much sheet metal those guys use.
And we're
talking about the presentation coming up was about reliability goals. We started chatting and I said, I had one of your units and it worked for us for about 10, 12 years. And then it failed. And the cost, I think, or the motor or the drivetrain failed. And so we decided to get the same model because it worked.
Yeah.
And he goes, we do that on purpose. It's not that we make it fail at 10 years. And I said, but why can't you make it like my grandmother's washing machine?
Right.
Right. She bought it in the 50s. It's still running. Right.
Right.
It has one switch. Right. It just turns on and off. Right. And it's cast iron. It weighs a ton. Right. And he goes, well, it costs too much to ship those things. Right. And people move now where your grandmother is still in the same house. Right.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before, but he said, we wanted to cut costs, and so shipping was a big cost. We got rid of the cast iron and we used milder steel.
Right.
And then
right.
we started realizing that, and there's only so many things that fail in these washing machines. So we characterized how long it takes for these motors and drivetrains to fail. Uh-huh. And we kind of got it dialed into that they'll probably have no failures, very, very few failures out to 10 and a half years.
Right,
and then they're very likely to fail.
Right,
you know, their probability of failure, their wear out just goes through the roof. And he goes, right. But we figured out that 10 years was about long enough for most consumers to realize that $500 washing machine they bought was worth it, and they will get another one the same right. brand again.
Right,
and he said that may change. People may expect 15 years in the future, or 5 years might be good enough. But we understand the failure mechanism well enough to satisfy the customer so that they get the value they're expecting out of the machine. Not
right.
not 50 years, right? But
right.
enough that they decide to buy again. And so they're making money right. by making something not last forever. And I said, well, why don't you can make things last a lot longer? And he goes, yeah, but then we don't sell any washing machines.
Well, and yeah, but also let's talk about technological innovation. I mean, now my washing machine is a high efficiency whatever system where it uses very little water. It's very complex in its cycle in that it sprays, it rotates, it locks the top of the lid and does these very complex sequence of washing the clothes and using a lot less water in the process, which is, of course, important these days in a lot of places.
Two rocks and a bucket on your porch will do less water and clean your clothes just as well. I mean, come on.
Well, right.
Do you need all
that
fancy crap?
Well, I don't know that I need all that fancy crap. I like the efficiency of it. Yeah. And also, I think that's helping the environment. But also, it's a mechanical system that you're talking about. And it's probably, in most cases, the gears, motors, mechanics mm-hmm. that will wear out, as you've mentioned. And that's the whole point.
I had our dishwasher at my old house. We had the control panel. The LEDs that indicated which button, which mixture of buttons right. and, were activated or not.
Uh-huh.
Those failed. The electronics, the LEDs failed. And the control mechanism of it. The dishwasher still worked. Kind of just randomly pushed buttons and then hope it turned on. So we were good, but we had no feedback mechanism anymore. So that wasn't.
Right. It's a partial failure that you could maybe deal with or live with.
That's right. But the idea is that there are business models out there, and they're constrained by just the weirdest things that drive this mentality that we're going to make money by profit. Now, I submit that there are some cases where you're still providing value to the customer. You're like, if you can do over-the-top service to mm-hmm. to repair the failures that do occur, mm-hmm. such that the customer is so satisfied that they recommend your. I'm still talking about Dell's service system. It's probably 20 years ago.
No, they have a very good service system. Let me tried to do. With my friend, they tried to satisfy him and sent out and even offered to send him a new computer. Mm-hmm. So, they went over the top to keep the customer satisfied. Unfortunately, it just didn't work out this time. Right. He got very frustrated.
Well, that's a way to profit from a failure, right? You improve the satisfaction level of your customer, right? And it leads to benefits. It's mm-hmm. not where you create a system where you have a monopoly on it. You're the only person that sells that spare part, and you're going to charge through the roof for it.
Well,
I think that
military contractors do that.
Well, I know, but I think that's just to me, that's just wrong.
Well, I agree with you, Fred. We're both on the same page. We're absolutely agreeing. But you're not, you know, the taxpayer pays for this, and it's money from the government. It's a profit center that, you know, with the idea of the reliability growth, for instance, Dr. Michael Peck came, you know, asked me if I wanted to be involved in a paper or something that I work in the commercial industry. The idea of reliability growth is something you do before the product is released.
Yeah.
And in the military, they pay you. I mean, the military contractors get paid to improve their product. So it's best that they bid low and make a minimum requirement. And then they get paid for improving the product, as well as in the field, they're providing spare parts and corrective actions, and, you know, field technicians and all kinds of things that there's profit from. And it's very secretive, of course, to get a any kind of defense contract. It requires high secrecy, a lot of clearances, and it makes it very restrictive. And as Dr. Peck of the Cal Center, University of Maryland, I've talked about this, and I said, you know, without competition, and this is the thing that drives Dell, Lenovo, HP, is that you and I can go out and buy any other, or a Samsung phone, or iPhone, or whatever, and I've switched manufacturers because of poor reliability. But if you put a replaceable battery in an iPhone, you could use that for probably 10 years without, if you didn't care about the technological innovations, because that's the thing that wears out. The limited life element in an iPhone is a battery.
Yeah.
And Apple and a lot of the companies now, and there's advantages, technical advantages, in the fact that they can make it more waterproof. If you have a opening or, you know, had a replaceable battery, you'd have to have worry
seal
about seals and all kinds of things, and customers would, you know, have leakage. And anyway, so there is some advantages to them making a sealable battery now with the waterproofing or water resistance, as we talked about in the previous podcast. So I'm all for that. But I think that it's unfortunate that the batteries only last about 2 to 3 years, because the rest of the electronics is absolutely wonderful. I have an old iPhone 4, and except for the battery, it really does a lot of things that I could use it for, like play music and other things.
Well, I still have some of the old iPods, and I have to be very careful about putting updating it, because a lot of the apps, when they upgrade, then don't work on that version.
Right.
And so the operating system is stopped being upgradable.
Right.
So it's, you know, to some extent that's planned obsolescence. To some extent that's just
some extent.
It's the innovation. It's the continued more features, more stuff.
Exactly. And that should be the motivation for getting customer to buy one of your new products is technological features, longer battery life, you know, better camera, better speed, whatever. There's just all kinds of things that can be improved, as opposed to making the product fail or have a built-in failure mechanism that's going to limit its life.
You know, this might be a topic for another discussion for us. I'll have to make a note to come back to it, is that, you know, the incentive systems around creating new products, because like you said, is these older phone, like the iPhone 4, it's still, if you're only using it to make and receive calls, it should still work. I mean, the networks are backward compatible. You know, we're on 4G now, or 3G, or LTE, whatever those things are.
LTE, right.
Right. But if you have an old flip phone from 10 years ago, it will still work.
Oh, my mother still uses her flip phone, and she's
right. So I mean, just, you know, we're talking about the washing machine efficiency. You know, we're filling up the landfill now with computers, and how many CRTs do you think are in the landfill?
Oh, it's really
old computer screens.
Yeah.
You know, not that I miss them at all. That's okay. I don't want to look at that flickering TV box and humming and making all that noise and.
Right, heat and other things.
And stuff. And whatever. Took up half my desk or more all the time.
Right.
But anyway, the idea is that I think we're in agreement, is this concept of locking yourself in so your customer's forced to pay through the nose to buy spares from you or similar type models is, I think, is short-sighted. Yeah, they can make a lot of money in the short term, but eventually it's not going to work for you. And I think part of it is our government system is driving that, but there are other cases like you mentioned. So if you want to read a little bit more about this, we'll link to the article in the show notes. Mm-hmm. And then let us know what you think. Is your business kind of on this trajectory? Maybe we should, if you have any ideas about how to break this cycle and get the message through, I would be interested. Kirk, I suspect you would be too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I'd love to hear it.
So get a hold of us. Let us know if you're kind of question in that area or not. Head over to reliability.fm. It's our podcast network. There's 5 shows now in the network. And you can find Speaking of Reliability and find comments fields and ways to get in touch with us through the site. And we'd love to hear from you. By the way, also, we haven't asked this in a while, is if you're listening through iTunes or Stitcher or one of the podcast networks, which many people do, is leave us a rating and a review. We really, really appreciate the feedback. But more importantly, it helps other people that would benefit from the show or would enjoy it to learn about it. The more ratings that we have, the more often it gets it arises in when people are looking for shows to listen to. So it not only helps us, it helps other people like you to find the show. And so we'd head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast network and leave a rating and review. That would be really helpful.
Yeah, we really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thanks much, Kirk. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.